Andrew Brunson, you don't call yourself a hero, but we do. And it's an honor to have you with us tonight. Thank you. Share your heart with us right now.
Thank you, Jim. It's not a subject we like to hear, and I don't like to talk about it a lot. It's kind of a heavy subject. But for 25 years, my wife, Noreen, and I were in Turkey ministering there. And I didn't really think much about the U.S. You know, our focus was on the Muslim world, and it still is. But since coming back to the States just over 2 years ago when I was released, I've just had a heaviness in my heart, a real urgency that keeps growing in my heart, is burning on my heart for the U.S. And it's because I think there is a dark, churning tidal wave of hostility and persecution that's about to crash onto the church in this country. And I, as you mentioned, many people don't think it can happen here, but it can. And many followers of Jesus throughout history and in many countries have experienced persecution. We haven't really seen intense persecution in the U.S., but we've been the exception. And I think this is because of the faithfulness of generations before us in this country. And we have certainly had many sins and mistakes as a nation, but many did honor God, and many leaders did this publicly. But we can see that our society has significantly changed in the last generation or two. And I think of God commanding Israel that they were supposed to, each generation was to train the next generation and pass his law down so that they would remain faithful to them. And they did that through generations. And this means that all it takes is one generation not being faithful, and you can lose what I would call the Judeo-Christian foundations of our culture. If we don't pass them on, you can lose them within a generation. And I think as we look at our country now, we can see that there's been a significant change in the next generations after ours. And now I see it's very obvious the commanding heights of our culture. I would call them the commanding heights, the corporate world, big tech, arts, media, entertainment, professional sports, schools, universities, government, bureaucracy. They're primarily populated by people who do not honor God, and in fact, many openly defy him. And these are the people who control the centers of power and influence in our culture. And they have the platforms to amplify their voices and shape public opinion. And they are increasingly hostile to those who identify clearly with Jesus and his teaching. Now, I like to underline, I'm not talking about politics. There is a political component, but I'm really trying to frame this as an issue, not of right versus left, but of those who are faithful followers of Jesus and those who are hostile to followers of Jesus. And I think there are two wedge issues that are going to drive persecution. And the first is the exclusivity of Jesus and salvation. That Jesus is the only way to God. And the second is that Jesus has the authority to demand obedience from his followers. And then in fact, he does make demands in a number of areas that are hotly contested in our culture. You can see sexual morality, gender identity, marriage, family life, biblical justice. And I think that those who are faithful to Jesus in these two areas, his exclusivity and salvation and his authority to demand obedience, are going to be labeled as evil people. And it's very hard to be misunderstood and labeled that way, to carry that. I think those who persecute will justify this persecution by saying that we are hate groups, that we carry a message of hate. And this, of course, gets it completely backward. It's a satanic lie. I look at Jesus, the most loving and kind man in history. But people said he was evil. They said he was demonic. And eventually an angry mob demanded that he be killed in a gruesome way. And Jesus said that just as the world hated him, the world will also hate his followers. And it's true. You mentioned earlier that Christians are the most persecuted religious group in the world. And why is this? I think it's because when we walk closely with Jesus, we carry his scent and people react to that. So I think this is what's going to happen, that in the name of being inclusive and tolerant, many are going to say that the followers of Jesus are a threat to their safety. They don't feel safe around them. And in our culture now, this has serious consequences. I think it's going to be something like this. You can't work here. Your views make people feel unsafe. You're a threat. And you can't use social media. There's going to be a silencing. You can't use our financial products. We won't process your payments. We're going to cancel your bank account, your credit cards. And you can imagine how difficult it would be to do a lot of things without those. And as for your church, we're closing down your website, your podcast. And actually, that's not enough. We'll strip you of your tax-exempt status because you have a message of hate. So these are some of the possible pressure points that I see coming, that you can be silenced, marginalized, shamed, canceled, deplatformed. So there's social and also financial pressure. And there are obviously steps beyond this. I don't know how far it will go, but it is difficult to be despised and hated. And this is how we will be seen. Several of the examples that I gave have already been applied to individuals and ministries. As I talk to people, that's just here and there, a person here, a ministry there. And I think that we're close to a tipping point. We have not reached the tipping point yet. But once we tip over, it can accelerate very quickly, and it can be applied on a very broad basis to many, many people. So at this point, we still have robust legal protection for freedom of religion. But I think as the commanding heights of our culture turn against the Judeo-Christian heritage that we have, these protections can erode very quickly. And the reason I have that is such a weight on me is just I feel weighed down by this in my heart, is that I think the majority of believers are not ready for the pressures of persecution. And I think this is very, very dangerous. I can tell you this from my own personal experience. Even though I had been a missionary for years, I had taught, I had preached in a difficult environment. So I had stood up to pressure in the past, but I came close to failing during the 2 years that I was in prison for my faith in Turkey. And I think one of the purposes that God had in my imprisonment was that I learned how to stand under pressure, to recognize the dangers and how to counteract them, even when I was weak and broken. And this is so that I can encourage other people like you to stand under pressure. And I would prefer to have a different message, a lighter and happier message, but this is the message God has assigned right now. And I want to mention, when I talk about preparing for hardship, some people immediately, they think of the very practical things, like having a generator, storing up food, having cash on hand. And there's nothing wrong with practical steps like this. But I'm really talking about, I'm focusing on preparation of the heart. There are other people who will talk about other things, but this is my assignment, is to focus on preparation of the heart. And I think if you talk to people who have gone through persecution and you ask them, how did you prepare? They're generally going to say they focused on preparing their heart, which is much more important and fundamental in determining whether we will stand faithful. And I more and more, I just see the ultimate goal is to remain faithful to the end, to just remain faithful to Jesus until the end. So I think one thing we need to do, and we're doing right now, especially, is begin to talk about and change our mindset about persecution. I think of something my mother told me when she visited me in detention, early on in my detention. And she said to me, I was broken, I was weeping. I say, Mom, look what's happening to me. I'm just so full of grief. And one thing she said to me is, well, Andrew, of course you're crying. Of course you're broken. This is suffering. If it were easy, they wouldn't call it suffering. And I said, Mom, you know, a little more encouragement here. But she was right. And she also said to me, to put things in perspective, she said, Andrew, there are many people who have suffered for Jesus Christ. There's a very long line that stretches back 2,000 years. My son, it is now your turn to stand in that line. And this was maybe a hard thing to hear, but it was the correct mindset. And we need to talk about persecution, be aware of persecution, plan for persecution. It needs to be on our radar screen. And I say this especially for pastors, for leaders, for influencers, for parents, for grandparents. If we don't talk about it, then when that dark wave hits, it is going to shock many people. And that places them in danger of being knocked out. I think there's so many pressures that we cannot escape from easily. Like if there's a serious illness or grief from loss, you don't have the option of escaping. But when it comes to persecution, the pressure that comes from persecution, the problem is that we can easily escape. You just have to compromise. You just have to renounce, and the pressure will stop. And that means that we need to prepare ourselves ahead of time so that when the pressure comes, so that when we are afraid, we do not run, but we stand firm. And we've been conditioned not to expect persecution in this country, so we need to change our mindset that this is not a time for ministry as usual in the church. We need to focus on preparing our hearts. I want to mention some risk areas that are especially dangerous if we're not ready when pressure comes. And the first is fear. And when Jesus talks to his disciples and he's preparing them for persecution that's coming, think, for example, Matthew 10, he warns them that they're going to encounter persecution and hardship, and he repeatedly admonishes them not to fear. And when there's a threat, the natural reaction is to be afraid. I don't know how to avoid the surge of adrenaline, the fast beating heart that comes when there's a threat. I've been afraid many, many times. But I think Jesus's emphasis is not so much do not feel fear, I can't control my feelings that much, but rather do not act out of fear. And the danger is that the person who surrenders to fear may end up compromising his faith and fall away and even deny Jesus. So fear is a very real risk. And it's one of the reasons why we prepare ahead of time, so that when we're afraid. A friend of mine says, I prepare so that I won't be afraid. And I said, well, I really admire you if you're not afraid, but I don't understand you. I know that I can be full of fear, and I know how powerful that is, how it can drive me to want to escape. And so I prepare myself ahead of time so that when I am afraid, I can make firm decisions that say, no, I am not going to yield. Another risk area, and this is the one that almost knocked me out. I came close to failing in this. And Jesus warns about it. He says, the love of many will grow cold. And it's in a context of persecution. And the reason that the heart, that the love of many believers, of the people of God, can grow cold toward God is because of offense, allowing offense toward God to take root in our hearts. And Jesus underlines three things there. One is people are offended because of the degree of wickedness that God will allow and because of the judgments that God will bring. And I think we are going to see what happens in the next years, what happens to a nation that turns its back on God. I think our country is already under judgment, but is going into periods of judgment. And the danger here is that the natural reaction when there is I've seen it, I've had it myself, when there's what is it called in English? when there's a natural disaster, people blame God. And when there's something that's so clearly from the sin of man, even a shooting in a school or a war, the natural reaction is still to blame God. If God is all loving and all powerful, how can you let this happen? And Jesus says there's going to be such a high degree of wickedness that God allows, and the judgments that come, that many believers are going to be offended and react in this way. And add to that persecution, that many believers are going to say, and we're not under judgment, but we live among a people. We're embedded in a people who are going to be under judgment. And we're going to be the object of their hostility. And I think many people are going to say, God, how can you allow this degree of persecution? And another area of offense that I think many are going to have that I had is that I could understand persecution intellectually. I knew that I was in prison because I was being persecuted for my faith. And I didn't like it, but I could understand that. What I did not understand was that I had no sense of God's presence, and that I felt that I was experiencing the silence of God for the 2 years I was in prison, that any sense of presence or way that I had received from God in the past had been cut off from me. And I felt that I was standing in darkness. I felt abandoned. And this is something that many believers have already felt, not just in persecution, but in normal crises that we go through. Many times we do have the sense of grace in God's presence, but there are times when we don't. And that is when we can be knocked out by offense. I allowed offense to take root in my heart. My heart was wounded toward God, and that led to my questioning his existence and then questioning his character, and it almost knocked me out. And especially in that first year, it was part of my brokenness. And the rebuilding that God took me through in the second year of prison, I would describe my imprisonment as the first year primarily being brokenness and the second year being a rebuilding process. And that the turning point for that was dealing with that offense, uprooting that offense and not letting it dominate me anymore, and pressing into the leadership of Jesus. I'm just going to mention this. I just read yesterday something that really bothered me, and it falls into the area of offense, just about Chinese believers who are being disappeared in their country and held secretly in places, and they're tortured and put under tremendous pressure. And one of the people who was in the interview said basically that after the first week of this, he tried to commit suicide, and that there were other believers there being held just because of their faith in Jesus, that after a week they wanted to die and just go to heaven. They would rather die than remain under the conditions that they were experiencing. And I also became suicidal. I understand this, but my reaction was, God, where are you in the midst of this? Here are some of your sons and daughters who are under so much pressure that they're trying to kill themselves, and who just want release. And maybe some of them also under that pressure end up renouncing the Lord, maybe not in their hearts, but with their mouths to escape the pressure. And the reaction in my heart is, God, where are you? And then I went through a lot of training my second year in prison, where I learned to just put my questions in a box and lock them up, and my doubts, and say, I don't need answers to have a relationship with you. And so I did that again. But my point is that when we are under pressure and in pain, then especially if we don't have a sense of God's presence or that a sense of grace, that it can knock us out if we're not paying attention to this. So I can't go on about that. I don't have time for that, but I think it's one of the real risks. Another area is that when pressure comes, we attempt to escape it through self-medication, with the pursuit of pleasure, drunkenness, drugs, sexual immorality, binging on all kinds of things, anything that allows us to escape. And I read an article recently that medical research has shown that when the brain is flooded with the stress hormone cortisol, and my brain was flooded with this. I couldn't sleep. I lost 50 pounds. I had constant panic attacks when I was in prison the first year. When we're flooded with this, one of the consequences is that the reward center of the brain is activated excessively and looks for hedonic stimuli. And so our brains are hardwired to escape when we're under pressure, to look for other stimuli. And we as believers have to be on guard against this pressure. As pressure increases against this danger, that we just want to escape when it comes. And this, I think, is especially pronounced in our culture, because there are some very good American values, but there are some very godless American values. And I think of the messaging, for example, that has come out of Hollywood and has really permeated our culture and even the church, that the pursuit of pleasure and self-actualization, self-fulfillment, is for many people their controlling value. And this basically means I do what feels good. My feelings and desires determine my truth. When I encounter hardship, I retreat to a safe place, because part of taking care of myself is avoiding suffering. And the way of Jesus is so different. He expects me to accept suffering voluntarily for his sake. And he says clearly that hardship is part of the cost of following him. And I can't do what I feel like doing. I have to do what he wants me to do. And there's no safe place I can retreat to. Safety lies on the other side of hardship after I push through. And so the underlying values of our culture and that have permeated the church are actually in opposition to the requirements of Jesus. And this makes the message of persevering, of making the disciplined decisions to stand faithful and persevere under persecution especially important. And I want to mention one last area of risk, and that's the area of deception. And Jesus warns about this, that the warnings he gives of deception are usually in the context of persecution. And I've wondered, what would this look like in our country? How is it possible that people could really be deceived just when they're being persecuted? And I mentioned the two wedge issues that I think are going to drive persecution. One is the exclusivity of Jesus and salvation, and the other his demands of obedience. And I think accepting these two truths is part of being a faithful follower of Jesus. And then I just mentioned the two ungodly American values of the pursuit of pleasure and self-fulfillment, self-actualization is the highest value. And I think the church has been marinating in these values to such a degree that many Christians have absorbed them. And now many who identify as Christian deny the exclusivity of Jesus and salvation. They think there are many ways to God. One of the hallmarks, as I said, of the culture is to say, I do what makes me feel good. My feelings determine my own truth. I live according to my truth. And according to God, there's God's truth. There's not my truth. There's God's truth. But many Christians have absorbed these values, and they now live according to their truth. And so, as I said, many who identify as Christians say that Jesus is not the way to salvation, the only way to salvation. He's one, but one among many. And many do not think the demands of Jesus for obedience apply to them. They've lost their sensitivity to sin. They justify all kinds of sinful behavior. So there's already a level of deception that has spread among believers. And many church leaders are even now hesitant to teach on these two wedge issues, not only because they want to avoid external opposition, but also because it will cause division and conflict within their church. Their church will divide. So I think this is what's coming. I think there's going to be an approved church, the church that aligns with progressive values. And that is going to be pitted against the church of hate. And the commanding heights of our culture, they are going to applaud the progressive church as loving and inclusive. They represent the God of love. And they're going to condemn those who remain faithful to Jesus on the issue of his exclusivity and salvation and the demands he makes for obedience. And this isn't a new tactic. My family, Noreen's side, her father's Hungarian. They had two generations, her father and grandfather, who suffered persecution under the communist government in Hungary. And communist governments have often allowed an approved church that they could control and that would serve the interests of the state. And this corrupted church ends up persecuting true Christians. As I said, we know that from our many Hungarian relatives who remained faithful during communist years. So I think there's going to be tremendous pressure on pastors to compromise. And those who do will be held up as examples of good and acceptable Christianity. And some leaders are going to compromise to avoid persecution. And that is, they're going to compromise out of cowardice. But I think there's a more insidious compromise because it comes actually from good motives, the desire to protect their ministry. People are going to think, if I avoid certain issues, if I avoid these wedge issues, then I will be able to continue my ministry. And my ministry is producing fruit and is serving a lot of people. And so the motives may be good, but in the end, that church will lose its purity and it'll lose its witness. And I think many sheep are going to be confused. This is where deception comes in. Many sheep are going to be confused by their leaders. They're going to be confused by the loud messaging from our culture, from those commanding heights of our culture. Should they go to the inclusive, loving church or to the church that so many say is unloving and bigoted and hateful? And I think this is how many people could drift away, not so much because they are directly denying Jesus and apostatizing, but through deception. And so I think that we are going to see an exodus from the church. Some will leave in confusion, and some will leave in order to save themselves from the rising cost of faithful discipleship, because it is difficult to be misunderstood and hated. And some, in the rush to distinguish themselves from the people of hate, will actually turn against and hate the people they had considered their brothers and sisters. And Jesus warned about this. He said, many will fall away and they will betray and hate one another. So deceived believers are going to attack faithful believers. So I think things are going to become very messy and confusing. So I think I have friends who are talking about the church growing. I think before we see expansion, I think we're going to see contraction in the church. And I have friends talking about revival. I hope revival comes, but I think before we see a revival fire, that we will experience refining fire. I have only a couple minutes, so I want to say two things. One is that persecution can be much more difficult than we think. One of the reasons I had such a difficult time is my expectations were very idealistic. I'm going to have a sense of grace. I'll have a sense of strength. I did have grace, but it was an unfelt grace. And a sense of strength, the joy of God's presence. And the experience that many people have, actually, who've been in prison for the Lord, I hope none of you end up in prison. Maybe we won't go to that point here. I don't know. Is that many experience what I would call the dark night of the soul when they're being persecuted. It can be much more difficult than we think. And I don't know if our theology of suffering has really dealt with this. I think of Richard Wurmbrand, who was a Romanian pastor who suffered in communist prisons for 14 years and was tortured there. And he talks about having cellmates there who were Christians who went insane. And you know, when I read that, it's like, no, wait, because the expectations that I would have, maybe you don't, but I had them, is God's grace is going to be sufficient to keep them from going insane. You know, God will not give me a challenge so difficult that I can't make it through. I can do all things through Christ and all that kind of thinking. And yet for these brothers, the pressure was so intense that they lost their sanity. And God could have given them the grace to not lose their sanity, but he didn't. The way Richard Wurmbrand dealt with that is he said, their insanity is beautiful to God. And that satisfied me in a way. It doesn't answer my questions, but they're, because of their faithfulness, because they refused to abandon Jesus, to deny him, they lost their minds. And this was a very precious sacrifice to God. Now he has made it right. You know, they are honored in heaven. He has made all things right. But here and now, things can be more difficult than we think. And this is why this is a weight on my heart, because I almost failed. I thank God I did not. And there are reasons for that, but there is danger. We need to let's not be naive. People can be knocked out and they will be knocked out. And so it is urgent that we prepare our hearts so that we are standing firm, so that we are faithful to the Lord. I want to end on a positive note, because this can be a very heavy subject and it can be very discouraging if we don't keep before us the truth of the supremacy of Jesus. I especially love the image of Jesus as the lion. He will not be defeated. And so I've talked about this dark tidal wave that is about to crash onto the church, and it's full of the anger of Satan. He wants to destroy the church. And we need to be sober-minded. As I mentioned, the fires of persecution, they can be destructive. And Jesus warns that many will be tempted to turn away in the midst of difficulties, and not everyone is going to remain faithful. But God is not going to allow Satan to destroy the church. In fact, he is going to use the pressures, this dark wave, in a redemptive way. It's dangerous, but he will use it in a redemptive way. He's going to be involved. The result will be good. God is going to use the pressure is to purify his church. He wants to seize the heart of his church, to recapture the heart of his people, and he is going to do that. But we need to keep before us, as we go into time of darkness, that God intends to use these pressures to refine us, and that this is going to set us up to be children of light in a very dark world. He's preparing us as we swim against a 1 mile an hour current. He's preparing us to swim against a 5 mile an hour current. The hardships we will go through will prepare us to carry the assignments he has for us. So I think I will stop there.
Andrew, every once in a while, I listen to somebody who, when they get done, I think, I wish I had 5 years to sit at this man's feet and learn from him and catch his spirit. And I've just gone through that again this moment. We are so grateful. The insights you share, there's so many times I wanted to say, stop right there. Take that last phrase, embellish it. Tell us more about that phrase. And I suspect you well could. We, on this side of heaven, we are constrained by time. I appreciate your analysis of the church, the pastors who say, I'm not going to preach on these topics so I can preserve my ministry. That is precisely what is taking place in tens of thousands of churches across the evangelical world. Your assessment, we're already very deep into your analysis. that's the tough news. I do want just a logistics thing for people to be aware of how they can read your mother's article. I was tipped off about this by a lady who told me it just came out, maybe even today, in Decision Magazine and then on her own website. Can you tell about that article and where people can go to read it? Tell the purpose of the article. Quite intriguing.
Yeah, my mother is especially concerned about preparing children, how parents and grandparents can prepare the next generation, their children, to be faithful to the Lord, and some very practical steps that they can take. And she, Decision Magazine, the print magazine, has a shorter version of it. The longer version that has more detail that I would encourage people to read is on the Decision Magazine website. And if you can look my mother's name up, it's Pamela Brunson, Pam Brunson. And that is a longer article with more detail, and I think it's well worth reading.
I have lived under, I guess, the illusion that somehow when people are faced with imprisonment and martyrdom, there must, because we've heard such stories of people operating under a unique grace of that. I guess I naively assumed that apparently everybody functions under that grace. What you're saying is some do, but yours was a grace, but it was an unfelt grace. I so want to go there. Our time is limited. Can you, in three sentences, define that a little more? You felt grace, but it was an unfelt grace.
There was grace that took me through, but I didn't have a sense of it. And I would say that I was disappointed in how little of a difference, a felt difference it made. I don't mean just a felt as in emotions and feelings, but in a sense of strength, peace, joy. And basically it was harder than I thought. And one of the things God wanted to teach me was to build perseverance, that the grace is his side of it. His faithfulness is undergirding my perseverance. Without it, I could not remain faithful. But he expected me to really exert myself and make decisions with my will, not my emotions, which were in turmoil, but decisions of disciplined persistence in pursuing him, in determining that I would be faithful. So sometimes people have talked about my imprisonment as the underlying narrative is the faithfulness of God. And I say, yes, that is true. But what God was really looking for from me, and what I felt more was the underlying narrative for me, was my faithfulness, that I needed to be faithful. And that is what I pressed into. And so that's why I say it can be harder than we think. There is grace, but we have to exert ourselves and to cooperate with it. And God doesn't always give. Faithfulness does not always look the way we would think. One of the verses that I really love, And the book I read the most in prison was 2 Timothy, where Paul is at the end of his ministry. He's in a dungeon now, not where he wrote Philippians. This is a second in prison in a dungeon, and he's expecting to be executed. And he says, wrapping up the letter to Timothy, he says, "The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and bring me safely into his heavenly kingdom." He's writing this in a dungeon, suffering, and he expects to be executed, but he says, "The Lord will rescue me from every evil deed and take me safely." So safety and rescue look different from what we would think. So sometimes grace looks different and in different measures than we would expect, and this is where I really emphasize, if I have more time, I would be emphasizing the need to exert ourselves and learn perseverance.
We're going to have you come back on because this has been so rich, not joyous, but so rich. And I'm deeply appreciative. You and I did not meet till you got out of prison, but I was very aware of what was going on. I kept up with reports. There were certain people in the State Department who kept me informed, people who are friends of yours. And I was aware you were losing weight and you were emotionally traumatized. There were actually times, I've never ever spoken of this, there were times at night I pictured what would it be like for me if I were in your situation. And I found my heart starting to pound, beat faster. And I realized how unprepared I was for what my friend who I'd never met, Andrew Brunson, was experiencing right that moment. There are so many of us that were emotionally attached to you, spiritually attached to you, that we were so joyous when we heard you were finally released.
And Jim, I do want to underline something that I've talked about, brokenness and the difficulty here, and that was very real. It almost knocked me out. But my story is much more than brokenness. It is also rebuilding. And so yeah. I don't want to leave people discouragement. I think one of the things God was teaching me every time that I went down and got up again, it built a strength and determination in me. And there are steps we can take. And God did rebuild me so that I came out stronger than when I went in.
I caught that. The first year was the brokenness. The second year was the rebuilding. And that's what we're going to have you come back at another time.